This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The search continues this hour in Adams County for two workers still missing after a building set to be demoed came crashing down on them. The company hired to perform that demolition was also involved in a 2015 fatal accident. We're going to talk about that and later get into some of the business at City Hall related to two recent indictments and the former Cincinnati Bengal at the center of all of it. Joining us to talk about it via Zoom is WCPO reporter Dan Monk. Dan, welcome back to our show.
Thanks for having me, Michael. How are you?
I'm doing well. Our thoughts are in Adams County with the people still searching for their loved ones there. And we do hope for a positive outcome. And we'll continue to follow that here on 91.7 FM and at WVXU.org. I know that you, our news partners, WCPO, are going to stay on top of this for future updates. But let's talk about the company involved. This is Kingfisher Development. This is a subsidiary of St. Louis-based Commercial Liability Partners. What exactly were they doing in Adams County?
Well, they bought this former coal-burning power plant to essentially redevelop it. They own not only this plant, but J.M. Stewart and Beckjord and Muskingum River. All of these are former coal-burning plants that this company buys from utilities, tears down the existing structure, and then tries to redevelop the site. That's their modus operandi. That's what they exist to do. And in the process of that, they hired a Detroit-based demolition contractor called Adamo Group, or Adamo Demolition. And that is the company that was overseeing this this demolition.
So Adamo is the company that was overseeing the demolition. Are the people involved, the people who are being searched for, are they employed by Adamo? Are they local contractors? What do we know?
They are Adamo employees. That's my understanding. And, you know, they found three folks, rescued them from the site, and they're still searching for two.
And so five total were missing originally, three recovered, two still being sought this hour. A very troubling story. But tell us about what happened back in December of 2015 involving the same company.
Actually, the same two companies. CLP, as it's known, hired Adamo Demolition in 2015 to bring down the Muskingum River plant. And while that happened in December of 2015, the company's CEO, Adamo's CEO, John T. Adamo, was struck and killed by a steel cable that broke loose from a coal conveyor, a bridge that crossed the Muskingum River. And they were taking down the bridge, and in the process, it became unstable. A cable broke loose, and it led to two injuries, one fatal. And that led to OSHA violations, four serious violations against the company in the summer of 2016. That case, initially, they proposed $28,000 in fines, and the amount was reduced to $12,500 in a 2017 settlement. In addition, the widow of John Adamo sued the company, and she settled her wrongful death lawsuit against the company last year.
And let's emphasize that again, this was the company's CEO that was killed at this site. And according to your reporting, again, struck and killed by a steel cable that broke loose from a conveyor bridge used to haul coal into the plant. So what changed after that, if anything? Do we know if any policy procedures or internal procedures were addressed?
No. So far, we have very little information on the plans for demolishing this plant. What we do know is that the building that collapsed was due to be demolished December 14th, next Monday, and during the prep work is when this collapse happened. The company Adamo, we couldn't find many records beyond the OSHA records in terms of their business operation in Ohio. We're trying to get records from Ohio EPA and from the Commerce Department, which handles building inspections for rural counties. And so we're in the process of trying to find out what we can about Adamo. That company did release a statement today saying that its priority is to work to search and recover missing workers. And they don't want to discuss the status of any employee out of respect for privacy and confidential personnel information.
We'll continue to follow that story. Two people still being sought this hour in Adams County after that collapse. We're talking with WCPO reporter Dan Monk. Dan, I can't applaud enough the reporting you did this week on the former Bengal, Chinedu Indukwe, who is at the center of the two most recent arrests involving Cincinnati City Council members. This is a deep dive into the background on what led to these arrests and Indukwe's involvement in development deals that have gone before City Council. Your headline at WCPO, I don't know if you wrote this, but someone did. It says, ex-Bengal Indukwe weaves a tangled web at City Hall. I mean, he has been before City Council multiple times for multiple projects, and some of these projects have caused contention in neighborhoods among members of council. The mayor was unhappy with members of council based on some of the conversations related to these developments. Talk about the tangled web.
Well, the central issue raised by the story is whether bribes the FBI alleges it made to advance one Indukwe project actually advanced another one in Mount Auburn. The issue is that according to the indictments, and a lot of this information wasn't known until the November indictments of P.G. Sittenfeld and Jeff Pastor. But if you go through the chronology of events in those indictments, all of the FBI alleged bribery activity that was taking place happened in the fall of 2018, which was the exact same time that Indukwe was coming to Cincinnati Council to advance a hotel project in Mount Auburn, for which he ultimately got $2.3 million worth of tax abatements. What was unusual about this case is that internally, the city was recommending a lower abatement amount, about $1.3 million for Indukwe. And two members of city council, Tamiya Denard and Greg Landsman, proposed increasing the subsidy for this project because they wanted the city to view it as a catalytic project that would stimulate the redevelopment of that entire neighborhood. So that's what happened in October of 2018. They came forward with this motion. Council subsequently voted for it, and it passed with six votes, and three of the six who voted ended up being indicted. Denard, of course, has pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 18 months for her alleged role in a bribery scheme on the Cincinnati riverfront. Now, it's important to note that the FBI case does not involve the Mount Auburn Hotel. It doesn't involve that river, it doesn't involve the Mount Auburn Hotel. And it's not alleged that Denard received any bribes related to Indukwe at all. However, the case that the FBI put against Sittenfeld and Pastor involves Convention Place Mall, where Indukwe was trying to win development rights so that he could redevelop that site at the corner of Fifth and Elm Streets. So both of these projects were happening simultaneously. Indukwe was talking to people at City Hall about developing Convention Place at the same time as he's talking to the same folks about developing a hotel in Mount Auburn. And the question is, if the FBI actually bribed two members of council to advance Convention Place, did they unintentionally advance the hotel project?
And that is the tangled web that's referenced throughout this extensive, exhaustive reporting. But just to emphasize, three members of Cincinnati City Council arrested this year. Tamiya Denard, earlier this year, she pleaded guilty and has been sentenced to prison for 18 months related to a different development, the music venue on the riverfront. But P.G. Sittenfeld and Jeff Pastor also indicted. They are saying that they are not guilty. Both hope to keep their seats on council, both currently suspended right now. And neither apparently were working together in the events that led up to these charges. They were independent of one another based on the reporting that has come out related to the charges. But as the charges go, Dan, we should note how the investigators from the federal government have used pretty flowery language to describe this former Cincinnati Bengal, Chinedu Indukwe. Chris Hoffman, the special agent in charge of the FBI office here in Cincinnati, referenced in Duqua's, quote, moral courage by coming forward. David DeVillers, the district attorney, he came out and talked about in Duqua being, quote, tired of being involved in this culture or this expectation of pay to play. But now that this timeline has been put together, Dan, are you hearing from other city officials who, I don't know if they should be expressing any doubt, or are they expressing any concern or questions about what has come forward?
Well, I know that David Mann, for example, has proposed removing city council from the negotiating process in economic development deals. And there is talk of a forensic evaluation of all economic development deals in the city, to sort of analyze where these connections happen and what they mean, and whether or not any of the past abatements passed by council were gained through, some underhanded means. And so I know that David Mann is bothered by the timing of these two events. And he says if they do a forensic evaluation, this should be among the first deals that is reviewed. But I haven't talked to other members of council about how they feel about this chronology.
Ben Dusing, the attorney for Jeff Pastor, one of the indicted members of council, questioned, quote, is it possible that the FBI got played? What's Dusing's motivation, or what's his characterization of events that lead him to raise that question?
Well, if it's true that FBI agents were bribing two members of council on Andukwe's behalf, as it's alleged in the indictment, then what does that mean for the credibility of Andukwe as a witness? Because at the same time, he's getting benefits from some of these same members of council. Is that a conflict of interest, I think he would raise? Or what did the FBI know about these cases? As they're bribing two members of council for another project, were they aware that Andukwe had business before city council and stood to gain from the bribes they were allegedly making? I should say that, P.G. Sittenfeld said there were no bribes that influenced his votes, and that there was no quid pro quo, as he put it. He claims that the prosecutor even admitted as much in a press conference. And Jeff Pastor's attorney, Ben Dusing, wouldn't comment on any particulars of the case. What he's worried about is why the government chose to use this particular witness, and what does that mean about his case, about their allegations against Jeff Pastor.
We're talking with Dan Monk, a reporter at WCPO, part of the I-team there. What can you tell us about where these development projects stand now? I understand that the hotel project in Mount Auburn is, according to your reporting, more than 11 months behind schedule.
Yeah, well, the building shell is completed. They're still working on the interior. Last I heard, they thought it could be open as early as February of next year. But in October, City Council was asked to extend the tax abatements, delay the deadlines in the tax abatement deal until December of 2021. So that means Andukwe has until the end of next year to finish the project and still qualify for these tax abatements. As a side deal, the Mount Auburn Community Council revoked its support for the project, and that led to a community agreement between Andukwe and the neighborhood groups there, in which he agreed to contribute at least $15,000 to Taft Elementary School. He's already written one check of $5,000 toward that end. And he agreed that if the hotel were to open later, or if it doesn't open at all, he'll have a conversation with the neighborhood about converting the use of that project so that it doesn't stay vacant. But at this point, it looks like the building is going to be finished sometime this summer, and the hotel would be staffed up and operational, it appears, sometime in the next year.
Carol Gibbs, the president and CEO of the Mount Auburn Community Development Corporation, according to your reporting, said that it's a hotspot in her neighborhood, that this is an area where drugs are sold and prostitution takes place, shootings take place. She said, quote, "We're afraid if this building stays vacant for a long period of time that it will create another haven of crime." Does it seem like now that they've got this agreement that they're back on the same level?
I think the neighborhood feels better about where this project is headed than they did going into the October timeframe, October of 2020, when they were, when Ndukwe was coming back and asking for council to delay, you know, the implementation of his tax abatement. Actually, what he was seeking was an extension that would keep the city from declaring this project in default, and he stood to lose his tax abatement. So he came back to council and he said, you know, we've had problems completing the project in a timely manner. And now with COVID-19, the hotel business is in disarray. I just need more time to complete this project and get the building up and running so that it can be successful. And I think the neighborhood ultimately, although they're cautious about what's happening going forward, I think they feel better about the prospect of a business actually opening there and it being part of the recovery of the neighborhood.
This story will be ongoing, undoubtedly, and hopefully you'll check back in with us for updates. Dan Monk, a reporter at WCPO, we really appreciate the time you gave us on this Friday. Hope you have a great weekend.
Same to you, Michael. Thanks.
And new charges are coming to your electric bill in Ohio to support the bailout of nuclear power plants. And yes, this is related to the legislation that landed the former State House Speaker under federal indictment. And later, crashes near the Brent Spence Bridge set a record last year, and we're on pace to exceed that this year. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Your electric bill in Ohio will soon have a new charge on it related to that nuclear bailout legislation. Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Andy Chow is on the phone with us now. Andy, welcome back to our program.
Hey, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure to have you. I guess we need to start with where we always start when we have you on and we talk about House Bill 6. Can you just give us the Cliff's Notes version again of what this legislation is?
Yep. The thing I always say is that House Bill 6 is a big, sweeping energy bill. It does a lot of things, but the headliner is that it bails out nuclear power plants. It gives out subsidies to two coal plants, one in Ohio, one in Indiana, and then it rolls back what have been known as renewable energy standards for more than 10 years now that mandates renewable energy use, and then it eliminates energy efficiency mandates. So those are the four big things that this bill does. But again, the main thing that people know it for and where most of the money is going towards is a nuclear power plant bailout.
And Andy, of course, they also know it because it's related to the federal indictment of Larry Householder, the former House Speaker there in Columbus. But now there's discussion in the Capitol about this legislation again. What's happening?
Yeah, so the lawmakers have HB 6 hanging over their heads. They've had it ever since July when Larry Householder was arrested and federal investigators accused him of running this bribery scheme. That scheme allegedly being that First Energy was funneling money to a dark money group that Householder controlled so that he could become speaker and in return he would pass this nuclear power plant bailout. Now, there are a lot of people in the legislation in the Ohio House, in the Ohio Senate, who voted for HB 6 because they say they wanted those provisions, that they wanted to find a way to keep the nuclear power plant open. And so they argue that the policy of HB 6 is still sound policy despite the now tainted process. So what we have right now in these last few weeks of session before the end of the year is that lawmakers are trying to decide, do they completely repeal HB 6? do they partially repeal it? Do they keep it? Or do they, and this is the latest version and possibly the vehicle going further, is just delay several of the provisions in HB 6. So we've been talking about how people are expecting to see a new charge on their electric bills starting in January. If they pass a delay, then those new charges would not start until January of 2022. That vehicle with the delay also has other things, including some auditing provisions to say, okay, we're going to send this money to the nuclear power plants, but if they don't really need it, then we're not going to send it to them and we're going to readjust the situation here.
Andy, I think a lot of people's ears might have perked up when they heard about new charges possibly appearing on their electric bill. Tell us, I mean, how much are we looking at here?
Sure. Yeah, so the new charges amount to $150 million a year for the nuclear power plants. But what it comes down to for each individual ratepayer is an additional 85 cents for your average residential customer a year. It's bigger for other customers, larger customers. And then another additional charge that people are expecting to see, and they have been seeing for a while now, because this was something that was put into place before this coming month, is another subsidy that is allowed to go to those coal plants. So we're talking about basically $2.35 of subsidies of new charges that people have seen and are about to see on their electric bills for the nuclear subsidies, the coal subsidies, and part of that do go to existing solar farms.
So what's the timeline for action to be taken?
You know, if anybody who's familiar with lame duck will tell you that this is something that will probably go down to the wire. They could pass it at any point. In order to avoid new charges, the House and Senate would have to pass something that also comes with an emergency clause so that the bill wouldn't have to wait 90 days in order to go into effect. But we've got just, you know, a couple of weeks here until the end of the year. And if nothing is passed, then session closes. That's the end of the 133rd General Assembly. And then the 134th General Assembly opens up and you would have to start all over again. And those charges would start up in January.
Columbus was pretty busy this week. I understand that there was more than a dozen different committee meetings, 100 bill hearings. I mean, did all those happen? That's what you reported earlier in the week.
Yeah, and that was before we started hearing of more confirmed COVID-19 cases.
And you're talking among the lawmakers.
Right, among the lawmakers and even more among the staff. And if you're wondering if any of those committees were delayed, most of them were not. They still went on. Now, session that was scheduled for Wednesday was canceled, but those 100 hearings for different bills still went on as usual in person. And this is causing a lot of concern among a lot of people who have been taking the COVID-19 pandemic seriously. When you go to the State House, you'll see a lot of people, mostly Republicans, who are not wearing their masks, not observing physical distance. And so that's really causing a lot of debate on Capitol Square.
How many lawmakers have tested positive in recent days?
So in recent days, and so to just go back, there have been others who tested positive earlier in the pandemic, but really this most recent outbreak, we've seen four legislators, two Republicans, two Democrats, who have tested positive. Now, all four of those Ohio House members all sit in the Finance Committee. So there are many who believe that this is sort of an outbreak that started from the Finance Committee, although the newly elected Speaker of the House, Bob Kupp, says that is not necessarily true. He doesn't want to admit that that's possibly the cause of the outbreak. But then, like we said, it's not just the representatives, it's their staff who are either feeling sick, waiting to get tested, maybe not feeling sick, but they do qualify as coming into close contact or exposure. So now they have to quarantine for 14 days because they didn't, you know, follow the recommendations of the CDC of wearing a mask and staying away from people.
What is the mask status? I don't know. Are you ever in the building?
I am not actually in the building, partly because we're trying to keep ourselves safe, and also because I've got kids at home who are not going to school right now.
Just to be clear, I mean, a lot of news organizations are doing that way. If there's a way to watch a stream of something, that's what we're doing in order to protect ourselves and others.
And that has been one thing that we have seen that's been a big benefit is that the House and Senate has really created a robust system for watching things virtually and watching things stream. But when you watch things, and when my bureau chief, Karen Kassler, who is at the State House, has been reporting that things almost seem, you know, if you're used to an environment where people are observing physical distance and where people are observing wearing the mask, then you might be pretty shocked to see a place like the State House where people are gathering in little pockets and people are not wearing their masks, and it just kind of seems like almost just an unusual sight to see to see people acting quote unquote normal during unusual times.
Certainly would be surprised to see that, but then not surprised to see what the ultimate outcome is, which is obviously COVID-19 positive cases. So before we let you run, this is a lame duck session. What should we be looking for when the new lawmakers come to town?
When the new lawmakers come to town, we're expecting to see, well, the House Republicans actually added to their supermajority. But we have been hearing from caucus meetings that they still strongly support Bob Cupp as Speaker. So, again, going back to earlier this year, we had Larry Householder as House Speaker, but then he was ousted, and then Bob Cupp came onto the scene. And it sounds like he still has the support among the Republican lawmakers. And so what we're going to see in these next few weeks is that people are going to try to push through certain pieces of legislation, but the fact that Republicans are actually coming back with even bigger numbers would probably tell them that if they can't pass some of their big priority bills in the next couple of weeks, they probably feel pretty confident going into next year with even more members on their side in both the House and Senate to be able to pass what they want to pass in the next session.
Andy Chow is a reporter with the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Read their extensive, very good reporting at statenews.org. Andy, thank you for the time you spent with us. I hope you have a great weekend.
Thanks, Michael. You too.
And the Brent Spence Bridge is set to reopen just in time for Christmas. December 23rd is still the target date. It's been shut down for weeks after a fiery crash involving two tractor trailers closing this major interstate artery and this important connection between Kentucky and Ohio. So when it reopens, what's the plan to address that troubled bridge and its corridor, perhaps once and for all? Inquirer reporter Julia Fair spoke with some Kentucky lawmakers and joins us now via Zoom. Julia, welcome back to our show.
Hey, Michael, thanks for having me.
I wanted to emphasize, Julia, that you spoke to some lawmakers. You did reach out to all 13 lawmakers who represent some part of Northern Kentucky. You didn't hear back from many.
No, I didn't. I heard back from four of them. We heard back from two Democrats and two Republicans.
And you should note, there are only two Democrats in the Northern Kentucky Legislative Caucus. So the two Democrats, they were unanimous in responding, but not so much on the Republican side. I don't suppose you've heard back from any of the other ones since this article was published.
Have not. You know, we really, really, really wanted to ask them how they plan to fund the future of the Brent Spence Bridge. And before we go into the ultimate funding question, I think it's important to know exactly why the bridge needs these upgrades. Since the accident, public officials have reiterated that the bridge is stable, but that hasn't been the issue that has propped up the discussion about building a new bridge for decades now. The bridge's capacity is the issue. More than 160,000 vehicles cross it a day, but it was built for 80,000 vehicles. So this new bridge that everybody keeps asking about is not going to replace the current one. It would just be built next to it to increase capacity. And that's estimated to cost $2.5 billion, which would also improve several miles of highway leading to and from the bridge.
Exactly. So it's more than just a bridge. It's an entire corridor. And that is something that's often lost on folks is that the Brent Spence Bridge, the one we know and drive across, it would stay. It is structurally sound. They would just be building what has been characterized as a companion bridge. But As you noted, that price tag is pretty high, and it's been concluded locally by transportation officials that it would require the use of tolling. It seemed like years ago Ohio was on board with this, but Kentucky has been adamantly against it, even codifying that at the state level through legislation that bars any use of tolling to fund a bridge that connects Kentucky to Ohio. They were very specific with that. But what did you hear from the lawmakers? You heard from Democrat Buddy Wheatley of Covington, Rachel Roberts of Newport, and then Republican Savannah Maddox of Dry Ridge and Chris McDaniel of Taylor Mill.
That's right. So we asked these all 13 lawmakers two questions. We asked them, given the recent incident, would you support a toll to fund this new bridge? We asked them to explain why or why not. And then we asked, if you don't support tolls, what's your plan? So Kent County Rep. Buddy Wheatley is the one who gave the most specific answer, but the other lawmakers said no to tolls or said it should be a last resort. But Wheatley gave a very specific answer. He said he would support a toll on through traffic, which would include, for example, freight drivers and like vacationers. That wouldn't include tolls on Northern Kentucky residents who use the bridge to work in Cincinnati, which is a big concern in the region. And so that was his answer. He gave some formula about how much should come from the federal government, because this is a major artery in, you know, freight delivery in America. But that was his specific answer.
So he at least opened up to the possibility of tolls as long as it appears to exempt local users. And Democrat Rachel Roberts of Campbell County, also, she's the one who referenced it as a last resort option. But what did the Republicans have to say?
You know, Savannah Maddox, she said that, you know, a lot of the funding should come from the federal government. She thinks that the state should be able to control how much, like, the federal money that is used for the bridge. But she was very against tolls. But the big problem about this project is that there needs to be some kind of local contribution to this project.
And Chris McDaniel, who wields a little bit of power in Frankfort these days as a state senator, oversees appropriations, his thoughts on the matter.
Yeah, so Chris McDaniel, he had some interesting thoughts. So, you know, he said funding continues to be the thorniest issue for this project, which everybody knows. He also said he doesn't like the idea of tolls. He said they don't have an exact funding solution yet, but it will include local, state, and federal conversations. So just more conversations, which, has been the history on this project.
And I envision we'll be having more conversations about this bridge in the future. But one thing to look forward to is that it is still on schedule to reopen in now less than 2 weeks.
That's right.
Well, that's one thing to look forward to. Julia, thank you so much for the time you gave us. We'll have you back on, I hope, very soon. Have a great weekend.
Sure thing. You too.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Mungs. It was a major fiery crash that closed the Brent Spence Bridge on I-75, but there have been plenty of other wrecks in that area, particularly on the Kentucky side. Let's talk about that now with WKRC Local 12 reporter James Pilcher, who joins us via Zoom. James, welcome back to our show.
Thanks for having me, Michael. How are you today?
I'm doing well. I understand you've pulled some data for a story you're reporting this Friday evening on Local 12. What do we know about accidents in the Brent Spence Bridge corridor?
That they're on the rise. Basically, I asked the Kentucky State Police for all the number of accidents between just before the 3rd Street on and off ramps all the way to the Kentucky State border. And from 2015, actually, they gave me back to 2010, but I'm looking from the beginning of 2015 to this year, there have been 598 accidents total. That includes 118 last year, which I think is an all-time high because I've been covering this bridge since 2002. So that's at least close to an all-time high if it isn't an all-time high. And then just this year, there have been 98. Until, you know, right up until that accident on November 11th. So if you do the math, we were on pace to match or exceed the number of accidents last year, which apparently was an all-time high. I do remember the number 120 was out there at one point. There were 120 one year. But that means, like you said, about an accident every two accidents every week.
And we should note, James, that I guess there was a period during this pandemic, during the initial lockdown, where there probably wasn't at least as much local traffic moving through there, but yet those numbers are still pretty high.
Yeah. And I've asked for some, you know, asked some experts on that. I don't know if it's going to make my story or not, but I can tell you that one of the things that they're talking about overall is that, and I've seen it on the roads, people, when they have a wide open road, tend to drive more aggressively. The other issue is that there are more distracted drivers on the road and people are using their phones more.
And we should note, James, that this isn't the entire highway we're talking about. It isn't just on the bridge, of course. It's a very small stretch of that road.
I pulled about 7 to 8 tenths of a mile. So if you think about it, that's probably one of the most accident prone stretches of highway in the entire region. Until recently, when we're getting an accident a day right now at the interchange between 275 and 471 because of all the rerouted traffic. There's at least one accident. There was a huge accident, a five-car accident on the Colm Tile Bridge on 275 just last night that I drove by. It's having its ripple effects everywhere. But when the bridge is open, even during the pandemic, it is a major, major traffic hotspot.
We're talking to WKRC reporter James Pilcher. And James, as you noted, you've been covering this bridge for almost 20 years or right at 20 years. It seemed like the conversation about what's just commonly referred to as the Brent Spence Bridge Corridor Project, whatever it might be, had kind of died down, that people had just decided to leave it alone, that it was not moving forward despite the efforts of two presidents, or at least the rhetoric of two presidents. And you did speak with Chris McDaniel, whom we referenced in our previous segment, the Taylor Mill Republican state senator. He told you that this incident has reset the conversation. In what way?
I think he doesn't want to go on record. He did say when he talked to me, he said specifically, you know, I want to do this without tolls. But he also said, we have to put everything on the table, back on the table. This accident has reopened people's eyes to just how vital and how congested and how connected that bridge really is. And what happens when it doesn't work, right? So, you know, it's structurally sound. And what the repairs are doing are going to make it that way. But when the economy starts recovering next year, that congestion is only going to increase and get worse, which means more accidents, which means more danger. You know, one of the other issues is that you can't just respond with one police car there. You have to do two or three police cars, even for a fender bender. There are no accident. There are no breakdown lanes. So that creates this huge hazard with all these trucks coming through. And they're just waiting for another repeat of what happened last month.
And again, this has been ongoing for a long time. When we talk about the conversation about the bridge, James, where is that conversation supposed to be taking place?
It's supposed to be taking place both in Washington and Frankfort. And quite frankly, in some local city halls, because there is still that local opposition. And if tolls are going to happen, they have to change the law, because I was there on the floor of the General Assembly when they passed the law saying no new bridge can be built in Kentucky across the Ohio River that includes tolls. I call it the Arnold Simpson Amendment because he got it slipped in there. The retired Rick Covington state legislator, he got it slipped in there because Covington was dead set against tolls. So when we talk about resetting the conversation and you're going to do tolls, that means you have to go back and undo legislation that was there and then go forward.
And it's been interesting to watch. I'll note that I'm a Covington resident. You can look out a window and see that there is significant diversion taking place through the city involving commercial vehicles and vehicles in general looking for a way to and from Cincinnati. But the city of Covington currently is seeing that. And I'm wondering what impact that might have. You get this occasionally when you have an accident on the bridge that causes a shutdown, or not a shutdown necessarily, but significant delays. Cars will pour over into the side streets in Covington. But this has been semi-permanent for the past several weeks, and you're getting a real taste for it. What anticipation should we have for the impact this diversion will have on the conversation? Does it add to the urgency, or do people point to it as, look, this is evidence that if you toll that bridge, there's going to be significant diversion?
There's people on both sides of that. There are people saying, look, you don't fix this problem, then, you know, you're going to have this more and more. But then there are, like, Covington mayor, I talked to the Covington mayor, Joe Meyer, about this, and he said, well, look, the tolls, it's going to divert 20 to 30,000 people onto local streets, and that's what we're going to be dealing with as well. So there's people on both sides of that argument. I mean, it's one of those where both sides have their points, but it's going to come down to don't forget, I know it's Kentucky's bridge, but Ohio has a huge say in this too, because they've got to fix everything on their end to make it happen. So it's a bi-state conversation.
We're talking with James Pilcher from Channel 12. We'll look for that story this evening related to crash data recently pulled from the files of the Kentucky State Police. This isn't the only thing you've worked on this week, though. James, you revisited a topic that, unfortunately, you've had to visit multiple times in a recent period, and that's human trafficking. And you explored more than just our area in your most recent reporting. Can you tell us what you found?
Yeah. So as I've worked on these stories over the last several years, I've gotten to know these organizations that are working hard to combat sex trafficking, particularly child sex trafficking. One of those is Shared Hope International. It's a nonprofit founded by a former congresswoman. She started on international, but then she realized the problem is just as bad here. So they started doing report cards on states, on how well the states are battling this. And one of the biggest things that they have found is that states are still allowing police and prosecutors to charge minors for prostitution and soliciting, even though those kids and minors might have been forced into the acts that they were committing. So, you know, they're basically being double victimized in the eyes of the advocates. And they say it's a deterrent because the kids don't trust the police because they're being arrested and they're being told not to trust the police by their pimps. So instead of getting them into treatment and getting them recovery help and putting them in jail and traumatizing them that way. And so what we found was 19 states are still allowing this. Including Ohio. And it didn't make this story, but earlier last month, I did another story specifically about Ohio. And the Ohio Attorney General said there are certain things that need to be changed about Ohio's laws, but he still feels that at least getting these kids into the system, even if you have to arrest them, is the best way to get them off the street and get them the assistance that they need. The system isn't set up for just, okay, we take you in as a child, prostitute, they hate that word, but a victim of child sex trafficking. And there's not a system to immediately get them into rehab or a home or away. The only place they have to put them is jail.
Do we see any common themes emerging from the lives of these children who are trafficked?
Yeah, broken homes. The people that get them into this system are experts at identifying troubled kids. The two women that I talked to for this story both had, one was victimized by her stepfather who started selling her. Then she ran away, and the only way she could survive was on the street selling herself. The other one had an alcoholic, troubled mother who was abusive. So she was running away and looking for something. And at 12 years old, this guy spotted her and got her into the life. So, yeah, that's the common theme, is that usually they're a victim already by the time that they get into the commercialization of it. And when money changes hands, it isn't like they flip a switch and they've made the decision, oh, I'm going to do this to make money. They've been groomed. They've been abused. They've been victimized already.
And what about the relationship to different parts of Ohio? Is it everywhere, or is it more urban? Is it more rural?
I didn't really get into that in terms of the localizing of the state. I do know that Toledo has been a major issue. They just had a major bust on this. The state attorney general announced a major bust on this up in the Youngstown area, including a major league umpire, believe it or not, who was buying kids for sex, allegedly. So, From what you've seen my stories out of Portsmouth in my previous position, so in current position, so it can happen in small towns, it can happen in big cities, You know, the one woman was suburban Seattle. The other woman was urban Toledo. So it can happen anywhere.
We're talking with James Pilcher from WKRC-TV. Before we let you run, James, I want to touch on your story about death row and Hamilton County and how much executions can cost or how much keeping people in prison like this can cost. What did you find in relation to Hamilton County compared to elsewhere around the state?
Well, there was the report came out on Monday from the Intercommunity Justice and Peace Center here in town. And basically, they analyzed court records of all the death row cases out of for the state, basically, but really focusing on Hamilton County. And what they found, first of all, Hamilton County currently has more people on death row than any county in the state. They also found that Cuyahoga and Hamilton County combined to account for more than half the people sent to death row. And only Cuyahoga has sent more people to death row than Hamilton County. So the other thing, the more interesting thing they found is that on average, a prosecution of a death row case in Hamilton County costs $1.1 million.
Per case.
Versus less than half a million to send somebody, or about a little bit more than $500,000 to send somebody to life without prison, life to prison without parole.
It was surprising.
Which in itself is a death sentence. What's that?
I was just going to say, it was surprising to note that this study showed 5% of all death penalty cases result in actual execution.
Less than 5%. I think like 2 to 3%. And the other interesting thing was that a lot of the disparity in terms of the justice system is that it's also because it's a funding issue. A lot of these smaller rural counties don't even try because they can't afford it. So I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head. There's like 60 counties that have never had an execution. And like, you know, there are more than 40 counties that have never even tried to put somebody on death row because they just can't afford it. So it becomes a situation where the haves can pursue this, you know, and the have nots don't. So, you know, the saying went, but from a legal expert, it's like, don't commit murder. If you're going to commit murder, don't do it in Hamilton, Lucas, or Cuyahoga County.
And we've got about a minute left, James. I know you reached out to Hamilton County Prosecutor Joe Dieters. He declined an interview, but he did issue a statement. What were his feelings on this?
He actually thinks that the report does raise some interesting issues. And he didn't come out and say, I'm against the death penalty necessarily. But he also said that as long as it meets my twofold criteria, if we don't have any issue with the proof, if the proof is undeniable, and B, it meets the statute, I'm going to bring it. And so that's just the law. So, you know, there are other people argue that, no, it's still a discretion. His opponent that he beat, Fennon Rucker, was going to not bring any death penalty cases at all. So, you know, but he did acknowledge that there were some major issues that needed to be addressed, and it takes too long and it is too expensive.
James Pilcher is a reporter with WKRC-TV Local 12. James, always appreciate the time you give us. Hope you have a great weekend.
Thank you, Michael. Good to talk to you.
And just to remind you, Cincinnati Edition repeats now at 9 o'clock in the evenings on weekdays here on 91.7, and of course on the weekends at 7 a.m. If you'd like to tune in then, you can always stream us at WVXU.org. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our technical director is Josh Elstro. I'm Michael Monks. We'll talk again on Monday. Hope you have a great weekend.